Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking time to be with us this week. This week I have with us two people at the same time who jointly wrote a book called What Wags the World? Tales of Conscious Awakening. And I might add, this book is similar to my consciousness book in that these two ladies interview multiple persons about their various spiritual epiphanies that's happened in their lives, what happens and how they came to do it and what they learned from it. Welcome, Miriam Knight and Julie Clayton. And I might also add that Julie and Miriam have a wonderful site called New Consciousness Review, where they review, write book reviews on books that come out, lots of them about consciousness, but other things too. So if you're looking for something good to read, take a visit to their site, New Consciousness Review. Welcome, Julie and Miriam.
Thank you, Eva. Good to be here.
Eva. Thank you. So I guess we'll go in order on the front of your book, Miriam Knight, starting with you. Tell us a little bit about you, what you do, what made, you know, whatever you want to say about the book, and then I'd like for Julie to take a few minutes and tell us who she is and where we can find her, because she also, I know that Julie also does editing. I don't know what else you do, and I know you have a radio show very similar to mine. So tell us a little about you before we get into the book.
Sure. Yes, my radio show is called New Consciousness Review, and it's on multiple platforms. And it was really the impetus for our book, because a lot of the people whose books I reviewed and then subsequently interviewed had the most amazing stories. And the more I got into them, the more I realized that they're the tip of a very large iceberg. So many people are having these awakening experiences, and they're of many different varieties. So I felt that if we could bring together a representative sample of stories, then the readers could possibly find an echo in these stories with their own experiences, and it would like give them permission to acknowledge things that they might have suppressed or thought, oh, well, nobody's going to believe me anyway. So the new consciousness is really happening, and that's the name of our website, New Consciousness Review, ncreview.com, and really the name of what I believe is happening in the world.
And Julie, what about you?
Well, I have had a pretty much a lifelong interest in consciousness, without even knowing it, in the early years. And I feel very blessed and privileged to work with Miriam as the reviews editor for New Consciousness Review. And we share, you know, the interest in both personal experiences of awakening and non-ordinary consciousness, and what it means in terms of, the larger social and global changes that we all, I think, feel at some level needs to occur in order for us to address the challenges of our time. So this book is just an extension of our passion for that and our interest in it. And as you said, Eva, yes, I am a freelance editor, and I work primarily with authors who are writing about such messages of in the new consciousness paradigm.
So I have to tell you, I'm a fan of this book, and I also happen to be one of the chapters. So I know how you found me, but how did you find everybody else? I mean, what made you drawn to one story or another one? And I do have to, I told you I was going to ask something like this before we even talked. So many people out there, let's see, I don't even know how to say this appropriately, but we hear a lot of people talk about things that sometimes they're looking for but haven't found, but they talk about it like it's found, and then it causes some people to, you know, have disbeliefs that what we're talking about is really true. So how did you kind of weigh to make sure you got credible folks?
Well, that actually was one of the main criteria for selecting the people. We have academics, we have professors, we have medical doctors. There are three or four medical doctors. There are several pastors, people who from the military, people who were high-ranking officers. In fact, one of our gals was a commander in the Navy. We have people who were at the peak of their game in business, CEOs of major organizations. These are credible people who had amazing experiences and had the courage to look inside and say, okay, what is happening here? What I believed was the nature of reality has shifted for me, and I'm going to tell my story. I have to tell my story. And those are the people that we pulled in.
And did you find any kind, and both of you feel free to talk whenever, you know, whenever you have something to say. Don't wait on me to ask you since,
thanks.
You know, there are two of you there, and I don't want to cut somebody out.
Well, I wanted to just add to what Miriam said. On a more pragmatic basis, many of these authors and contributors we come across through New Consciousness Review, both via their books and through Miriam's radio show. So, you know, we have an awareness of many, many people, and then there was, as Miriam said, you know, a selection process that took place.
And did you find, if you could pick out one common thread for us to talk, start with, what would that be? What was the glaring thing that you seemed to find all of the people had?
I would
or profound say profound might be a better word. What profound?
The stories were as individual as the people. If I were to put my finger on one common thread, it would be a sense of connection to the universal mind, to spirit. People who really did not have any particular religious background or spiritual orientation connected into the mystery and knew in the very depth of their being that we are one. We have a direct connection to source.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to add to that, too, that, you know, because I was looking at the common themes, and one of the things that stood out for me is that in their own way, as Miriam said, these are all individual, but in their own way, it seems everyone speaks to the theme that we all are living in a limited mode of thinking and therefore, by extension, limited view of reality. And again, that this is changing and wants to change and needs to change. And so each person was speaking to that in their own way. And a recognition of interconnectedness, as Miriam said, you know, there's an embracing of the uncertainty that new modes of thinking bring, but it is grounded and based in a recognition of interconnectedness, and changing our thinking to embrace that.
Did you find, did these things typically happen out of the blue and unexpectedly, or was it something that the people were looking for and suddenly found?
Both,
does that make sense?
Depending on the on the individual. In some cases, it was this kind of gnawing feeling that there has to be more than this. This gnawing feeling that I am not doing in my life that which I was put here to do. There must be more. What is it? In other cases, and so they set out to to, they contemplated, they set out to be the change that they wanted to see in the world. A young man like Paul Chappelle, who was in the military, he grew up as a combination of Korean and Black American, and he developed empathy for people who were minorities, oppressed, poor, and through this empathy, he joined the military, but then he became a warrior for peace. That was his epiphany. That was his awakening. In other cases, it was people who had had a dark night of the soul, whose businesses had collapsed, whose health had collapsed, who had reached the very bottom, and they called out for help, and the universe responded, sometimes in quiet ways, sometimes in very dramatic ways by showing up as angels or energies. It's very individual across the board, but it touches into, again, the mystery, the interconnection.
So I want to give you some time just right now without me just questioning, because I have a tendency to do deposition-like interviews. So I'm going to try to give you your own space here, since this is a unique kind of book for my story. What would you like to tell us about this book and your work with this?
Julie?
Yeah, well, I wanted to actually add to what Miriam was saying a moment ago and give a couple more examples. Foster Gamble, for example, who produced the documentary Thrive, he talks about his experience, which actually first occurred for him when he was just 14 years old, and he was riding in the school bus, going to school, gazing out of the window, and suddenly had what he can only describe as a full-blown vision of a whirlpool vortex of light that then turned into a solar system with the sun in the center and the planets going around on the outside. And from there, it turned into an atom with the nucleus at the center and the electrons going around the outside. And then he got the whole body feeling, as he describes it, that he too was this same pattern, which he came to realize later was what is called the Taurus pattern. And so this is what really inspired him and got him to pursue really what is the fundamental pattern of the universe. And he spent, you know, the rest of his life doing that. And fortunately for us, one of the outcomes was his documentary, Thrive. By contrast, someone like Peter Russell, who is a scientist and philosopher, I'm sure many people are familiar with his name, he started out as a scientist, as a mathematician, actually. And he was studying all of the, you know, these mathematical equations, and he realized that none of them explained why there was consciousness in the first place. And so it was really sort of his own inquiry, self-inquiry, and academic journey that led him to start to look at other disciplines. So he looked into philosophy and psychology, and still none of these could answer that question for him. And then he was drawn to the Eastern spiritual and wisdom traditions, and he actually went to India for a while and studied meditation. And it was from that he realized that we're looking at it backwards. We, the scientists, so to speak, we're looking at consciousness back to front, that, in fact, spiritually, we were looking outside instead of in, and in terms of consciousness, we were asking, why are we conscious? And instead, we should be asking, when are we conscious? And of course, the answer is always. He says consciousness is always there. It's fundamental to the universe. So those are two, you know, really prime examples of the distinctness of each of these stories and the people and how they have come to tell these tales that we've included in What Wags the World.
I'd like to add something about Foster Gamble. Foster was one of the heirs of the Procter & Gamble family.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, left all of that behind. He kind of became the white sheep of the family, if you will, in order to pursue his consciousness work, pursue this vision of the nature of the universe. And then there's somebody like Dr. Larry Dossey, who was a medical doctor who, in, I guess, his 40s, had a dream about the child of one of his colleagues and then came in to work the next day, and everything that he had dreamed about played out. And, you know, he asked his friend, did you mention this to anybody? You know, is there any way I could have known? And the friend said, no, absolutely. I only mentioned it to the radiologist. And so he went on to have several more precognitive dreams. And that just blew his mind, but it made him believe in what he later termed non-locality or non-local awareness, which was the fact that the mind, consciousness, behaves non-locally. It manifests as if it is not, you know, in us, as if it is spread out through the universe. So this is why I mention the very credible nature of the people that we have interviewed. You know, they all questioned it, but they knew that they were not crazy. You know, once you get past that point of questioning your own sanity, you then know that something very profound has happened to you and that you will never look at the universe the same way again.
I so get that. It makes so much sense to me. I've had to live that. So did you find that... Well, one thing I'd like for my listeners to come away with tonight about this is many, many of us who are approaching shift or in the midst of a shift, one thing that most of us have to experience is dark nights of the soul or bad things. Because when consciousness is knocking at your door and you don't listen, it has to get your attention some way. So I'd like them to know, come away with hope. Many of these people had dark nights of the soul, right? And some wonderful thing happened through their realization. So there's hope, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So can you tell us your opinion about that? You know, did that come through your thinking process? What did most people come to say about that when you were doing their interview? Give us hope for knowing that we can get out of the dark night of soul. And if you are in a dark night, if something bad happened, is that your? Do you have to stay there? Is that the path? Or is there something you can do to stop the suffering? Does that make sense?
Yeah, very, very, very deep, profound questions, Eva. I think that not everybody has a dark night of the soul in the sense that I interpret what you're saying or make meaning of what you're saying. Certainly a number of people have, such as Anita Murjani, whose tale is quite well known, seeing as she was introduced by Wayne Dyer to the world.
Well, that was more a near-death experience rather than a dark night of the soul.
Yeah, definitely. It was a near-death experience. I guess I'm thinking of it as a dark night of the soul in the sense that she was ill for a very long time, And I'm sure she had to reconcile that somehow within her. So not everybody has a dark night of the soul, but when it does happen, it is always a doorway to something else. Always, it's never. There isn't anybody who gets stuck there, as far as I know. And what comes out on the other side is often largely a deepened sense of connection with humanity, with love, with appreciation and compassion, a deepened compassion, and a strengthened sense of purpose in the world, which is often largely founded in this wanting to let other people know that it's okay to be compassionate, to be caring, to take care of others.
So did you find it a common thread that people talk about being in the moment?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Eva?
Based on my own experience, I suffered from profound depression or dark nights of the soul the majority of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I have learned today that, you know, I guess you get whatever you ask for in consciousness. So if you want to do this thing or you want to do that thing, you get just that, the desire of want for that thing. So if you're in that dark night, kind of what I was wondering about is the bliss or the happiness is right there in front of your face, and all you have to do is blink and say, I am that, but really believe it, and you can be that thing. If you're in misery, and let's say you're in misery, and so you go outside and you can look at the world and think how miserable it is, or you can look at the blue sky and the wind, you know, tinkling the leaves and go, oh my God, what a glorious day. So did you find people have those amazing experiences where they suddenly got that in an instant, that really everything that they saw that was so miserable was just a thought process?
Absolutely.
How did they get out of their miserable places? I mean, don't most of them learn those lessons that really it's all in the mind? Just stop doing it?
I think the process of making that switch is what gives them the spiritual growth. That actually is the lesson. I remember when I interviewed Eben Alexander, whose book became very popular, this medical doctor who had a near-death experience. He wrote a book called Proof of Heaven. And he talked about, in his coma, going into this kind of dark, mud, kind of bardo, you know, intermediate purgatory thing. And it felt like he was there for a long time. And all it took was an awareness that he could get out of it. He was remembering a tune, and it suddenly, in an instant, pulled him out. And I think, you know, they say, as above, so below. I think this is an example of the kind of mental switch that one can turn when you are at the lowest point and when you say, okay, I give up, show me. The universe is so compassionate, whether they will show you through the inspiration of your higher self, through an angel, through a guide, through a synchronistic happening or a sign or a symbol, there is something available to you that will enable you to make the choice to live, to thrive, to be happy. The other thing I was reminded of was that a lot of people in their childhood have been very badly abused. And they developed this hyper-awareness, this hyper-vigilance, because they never knew when some new threat was going to be coming towards them. And it was this hypervigilance that opened them up dimensionally, psychically. And I am wondering if modern life, with all of its threats and stresses and chaos, has been putting all of this stress on people so that in their hypervigilant state, they are now opening up in much greater numbers than they have been in the past, that it's a kind of the same kind of reaction to outside threats, whether it's dark night of the soul or physical or mental abuse, opening up and seeing, wait a moment, there is a benevolent universe out there, and I do not have to suffer. Suffering is in my mind. It's how I interpret the situation, how I react to the situation. And that is the only control I have, is my reaction and my perception. So I can change it, which is, I think, what you were saying, Eva.
Yes, yes. So if you had to pick a story that... Well, let me ask you this. Have you had a story in your life that rocked your world? Either one of you?
I think both of us have, yeah.
Tell us your stories. You didn't write about your own selves in here, so tell us about you.
I'll start.
Actually, Julie did.
Yeah, I actually did. Mine was actually, I sort of followed the format of the rest of the contributors because Miriam did such a brilliant job of introducing the book and the message and the theme and the purpose of our putting it all together. And I say very plainly, I personally have not had a dramatic, you know, awakening experience for me. It's been a slow burn, punctuated by three things, I guess. One is I have always, from the time of, I can remember, been connected with my dreams, meaning that they've always been as real to me as waking life, and that continues to this day, by the way. and I say, I don't know if I actually said in my intro, that my first waking memory is actually of a dream. So, you know, from a little child, my first waking memory is a dream of having this dream. Had many, many intuitive moments. You know, you could call them psychic, you could call them intuitive, just awarenesses that are beyond my rational way of knowing. When I was much younger, I went through probably about 10 years of intense deja vu experiences. When I say intense, I mean repetitive, regularly. So for me, I did have some experiences, one of which I'll just recount briefly. I was driving on a feeder road in Southern California with a friend and her daughter in my car, and there was another car coming towards us, so we were going about 45 miles an hour, another car coming towards us, and I looked up, and the car was in my lane, and I, as I said, sort of psychically looked into the driver's eyes. She was too far away for me to actually see her eyes, but I peered into her, and I could tell that she actually was not mentally cognizant. Something was going on for her. And I quickly calculated that I should actually stay in my own lane rather than swerving into the other lane to get out of her way, because I was planning that she would realize her mistake at the last moment and instinctively swerve. So I just stayed in the lane. And of course, all this is happening very, very quickly. And I realized that she actually wasn't coming to awareness, and that we were going to hit head on. And I put my head down. I had both hands on the steering wheel, and I dropped my head. And I said to anyone who was listening, I surrender. And I did. I was completely calm. I surrender. And it, you know, a fraction of a moment later, when we should have hit, I looked up and the car literally missed me by inches, literally. And I say, you know, I say it was like the divine finger just came and gently pushed it out of the way. I've had a few experiences like that, you know, nothing earth-shattering, but just enough to get my attention. And I, as I say in my intro, then I pulled over to the side of the road and the adrenaline kicked in and I was shaking like a leaf. And I looked in my rearview mirror and the car had disappeared. I didn't see it, and this was a straight road. So a few interesting moments for me, but nothing earth-shattering, just, you know, a slow, gradual interest and awareness, and eventually leading me to get a master's degree in consciousness in my late 30s. And the journey continues.
Before we move on, do you have anything you want to add there, Miriam?
Well, my story is that I was in business. I was chief financial officer of a multinational software company. I was a jet-setting business executive. My husband was a lawyer and a merchant banker. We were about as left-brained and, you know, corporate as they come. And a close friend of ours killed himself and then, in regret, started trying to get a message through Jeffrey to his son. And he kept on, you know, kind of trying to pierce Jeffrey's consciousness, and it kind of blew him open psychically to the extent that he started seeing things about people. And he saw one of his friends on his way to the cemetery and told him that he needed to go to the doctor now, that he would be dead in a few days if he didn't. And when the friend did go, he found that three of his four coronary arteries were totally occluded and one was partially occluded. So he saved his life. And because we were so close, you know, I started reading everything I could about these phenomena. And this is what really kind of shifted us onto what I would call the spiritual path. My husband became a hypnotherapist. I became an energy healer. And then when we came to the States from England, I ended up publishing a holistic newspaper and then starting New Consciousness Review. So you never know what method the universe is going to take to get your attention, but you might want to listen.
So did you, when you were interviewing these people, and I don't know the proper way to ask this question, so I'm going to do the best way I can. I believe that, you know, consciousness is two different things. It's the ground of all being, or the irreducible unit of an atom, or God, you know, the everything, the whole of everything. But I also think there's another definition, gradients and awareness, you know, which are two completely different things. So did you find when you were interviewing these people that their stories indicated vastly different gradients in awareness, or did they all seem that they were kind of close together with one another? I don't know if that makes any sense or not. I can see it in my head, but it's hard to put words to it.
I think I know exactly what you're speaking to, and it's part of the problem, quote unquote, of trying to talk about consciousness is that it is both local and cosmic or universal, and that we confuse the two, we intermesh the two, when in fact they do mean completely different things, or at least the meaning for us is completely different. I think that what I noticed from the people that Miriam interviewed is that it was largely both, in that there was a personal each person, I would probably say without exception, each person spoke to their own personal local shift in gradients of awareness. So they were opened up or they were awakened. You know, we use all these words to try to describe that transformational process or moment. And simultaneously, it seems to have led them to a greater understanding and experience of the cosmic consciousness. And I think this is a key aspect that hopefully the book communicates, is that it's both, that there is more to our reality than our current paradigm of limited thinking entails and allows us, and that, in fact, what we're moving toward in terms of shifting both our, you know, our gradients of awareness is to merge the two, to marry the two, to bring the science and spirit together, to bring the local and the cosmic together, that it is through this merging, through this wholeness, that we will then have or find or have access to the inner resources that we need to address the challenges of modernity.
One of the quotes that I love from Peter Russell is that he says, without realizing it, science is actually pointing to the fact that the fundamental nature of the universe must be more of the nature of mind than of the nature of matter. And interestingly enough, just 2 days ago, some scientists at Harvard made a big splash with an announcement that they had just done an experiment of telepathically transmitting a message from Mumbai to Paris using electromagnetic interfaces, but nothing in between. So I think science is starting to catch up with what we have been intuitively accessing.
I wish I could stop right here and ask you about that, but I'm going to email you and ask you who those folks were later.
I'll send you the link.
I want to know about that. One thing that I think is very important result of your book is, I know from my own personal experience, after the event happened and I had my epiphany or whatever word that you want to call it, it made me feel different, and it made me feel alone, and it made me feel outcast, and it made me feel very misunderstood because people thought I was crazy. You know, I go to bed one night and wake up some other woman with different... It certainly drove me toward humanitarianism, but still people thought that was weird. And so one of the things that I think that your book does for us is provide a tribe almost. You know, it's something on black and white and a piece of paper saying you're not the only one that this happened and there's nothing wrong with you that this happened. And there are people in there, imagine if you needed someone, because it can make people suicidal, to be honest. It can really make people suicidal. And I was fortunate enough to have Elmer Green and the people at ISEAM who understood and mentored me when it happened. I met them after a couple of years after M, so I had to be tormented for a few years, but at least I found them. So for people who need someone, I imagine anyone in this book would have no objection, you know, if you went to their website and reached out, or either one of you. I mean, it's a resource for folks who are struggling. At least that's the way I perceive it.
Well, thank you, Eva. I really appreciate your saying that. And, you know, I think that this was a primary driving force for Miriam and I in putting this book together. And I love your word, provide a tribe. Personally, I love that. That resonates for me. But what I wanted to say is that we're hoping that this book will help people who are having or do have had or may have the experience that you're referring to, feeling like an outcast or ostracized or crazy or weird or, you know, what have you. And we're hoping that by bringing these voices forward that we not only, you know, reassure people you're not crazy, but also you're not alone, that, you know, we want to help to normalize the language and these experiences, these non-ordinary experiences, because they're happening all the time. They just don't get the airtime. I was just looking in Cynthia Sue Larson's book, Quantum Jumps, and she states over 90% of people report noticing synchronicity and coincidences, and she goes on to state other things. And I thought, well, that, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. I thought you finished. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that, I was just going to say, I thought that was a very interesting statistic and really supports what we're saying here.
Well, you know, years ago, and it's been, gosh, I want to say it's probably been 10 years or more, I interviewed this woman at Noetic Sciences named Cassandra Wheaton. And I remember her saying that they had just completed a study, and I don't remember how she said they did it, but they had just completed a study where they were interviewing people about spontaneous spiritual epiphanies. And they had a whole lot of them. I don't remember if it was hundreds or thousands, but a whole lot of people. And what the result of the study said was that there were more documented cases of spontaneous enlightenment or epiphanies, whatever you want to call it, that occurred beginning in the early to mid-90s than ever before in the history of time. Documented cases, okay, that's the keyword here, in the history of time. So according to them and everybody else, something is indeed happening. And I just want to say too. Sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to make another point about children. You know, a lot of children are, particularly before the age of 5 or 6, are very awake and open to extra-dimensional, multidimensional influences, and can see auras, can have precognitive experiences, and it tends to scare their parents. So their parents, you know, the sort of classical imaginary friend who happens to be an angel. So their parents tend to shut them down. Or think that they're bad or it's from the devil. One of the things that I hope our book will do is show that this is, on the contrary, this is a high spiritual experience. This is bringing people closer to what one might call the universal experience of God or source, or spirit, or the creator, whatever you want to call this originating loving energy of the universe, this is common to us all. And if we can recognize this same Godhead in each other's cultural stories, that will bring us together as a humanity.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, many people think that just because someone has one of these experiences, as you think about in spiritual enlightenment, that everything's hunky-dory. It's not always hunky-dory when it first happens to the person because they're so misunderstood. And to these children who are born into this world, and they're different, and they know they're different. Mm-hmm. So if you have someone in your life that this has happened to, believe them. If these are your children, nurture them, support them. PMH Atwater has a really good book. Can't think of the name of it, but if you just Google PMH Atwater, you'll find these books about how to raise these children so that they grow up and be supportive of the world and support them emotionally, because otherwise it can really go off in the weeds without the support you need. So I think that's a great thing that you've done for the adults with your book, and I thank you. So what else would you like us to know? We've got about 10 minutes left.
Well, I just wanted to add a little bit from Barbara Berger, talking about the process of transformation. And one of the things that she says that I think is so practical, she says, is that it's not a linear path to awakening for most people, and it's a process, not a one-time event, even for people who have had a powerful awakening experience, or several, like I've had. I've noticed that spiritual seekers are often naive about that. They think, I'm going to get it and be saved. And she says, I think a more realistic attitude to all of this soul evolution is that challenges, anguish, trauma, they're often the catalysts for spiritual awakening. And she says, part of the problem is the confusion between the absolute and the relative. The importance of an awakening experience is it gives us a glimpse of who and what we are, but we need to find the right balance between the everyday psychological aspects of our lives and the greater spiritual reality in order to have a satisfying life. The challenge for many of us today is how we integrate all of this and use it to realize our fullest potential and be of service. And I think this is what, we've been talking around in many different ways, including what we're just saying about the children. It's the integration of what is not familiar with our daily lives that is the process, and it is a process.
That's exactly right. It really is exactly right. So, what other, if you had a second thing that was a profound eye-opener to you with what you've done, either a personal experience that someone had or a gleaning of information that you got or an assimilation of information that you got from interviewing all of these people, what would that be? Or do you have one?
Miriam?
You there, Miriam?
Uh-oh.
Did we drop her?
It sounds as though we may have. Oh, dear.
Wow, I didn't even know she was gone. Silent. Wonder what happened. Well, what about you, Julie? Do you have... what was the biggest thing that you walked away? How many people did you interview for
37. We have 37 contributors. Miriam actually did the live interviews, the one-on-ones, and we actually interviewed more than that. But as things happen, there was a little bit of ebb and flow, and we ended up with these 37 people, yourself included. I personally walked away with the sense that we're hoping readers will gain from this, just a sense of the magic and mystery of the universe. It's so much bigger. There's so much more to it than we recognize, than we understand with our rational minds, and that whatever your experience may be, there's a place for it in that larger universe, and we're not alone, and we are all moving towards something, I think, quite profound in terms of changing our thinking and therefore changing how we move forward toward the future we say that we want, because as we know, as to paraphrase Einstein, we can't create the reality, something different with the same mind. So I believe that the shift in thinking, the shift in consciousness, the shift in awareness is leading us toward what we need to be able to create what we want, what we say that we want in terms of the future.
Another thing that I think this book perhaps will benefit your readers and my listeners by is, When you're on the seeking path, or if you're interested and you're curious and you're looking out there to put your finger on something that helps you understand what you're looking for. You know, we hear many people say, well, this is the way it's got to be. Somebody sent me a book just this week. It was like a guru kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
You do these steps and you'll be enlightened. And mm-hmm. I wanted to write this guy back and say, there's no steps to enlightenment. It's an occurrence or an event, and it's different for every single person. So, reading this book gives you many different ideas about how a shift can promulgate in different people. It's not necessarily one way for everyone.
Yes, and I think that really stands out because everyone's story is so completely different. And enlightenment, it's not a one-time event either. It too is a process. It's an awareness. We may have a spark of enlightenment where we suddenly perceive things in a much different way, and from that place, we reassess and realign how we relate with the world, how we relate with our family and relations and who we are and what we do, and everything shifts, and then we could have another, epiphany or moment of enlightenment, and everything recalibrates once again. It's an ongoing process. It's the beauty of being alive, I really think, and many people.
Let me ask you one thing, because we got about three minutes, okay?
Okay.
This whole show we've been talking about your book about enlightenment. If you have to put a definition on enlightenment, what is that thing? That Masters in Consciousness will come in handy right now.
Yeah, well, you go to school to learn, and I don't think I ever left it. I don't know that I would want to say the book is about enlightenment. It is a tales of conscious awakening. Awakening, I personally would not say that that is the equivalent to enlightenment. I think enlightenment is a, as I said, a process, and I think it is the marriage of intellect and wisdom. And I think that's, where enlightenment comes to us. So I don't know that I can give you a definitive definition for it.
That's okay. Just wanted to know what your definition was. That's all right. So whatever you say is perfect. So, my dear, tell us one more time where we can find both you and Miriam, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry we've lost Miriam. Miriam is the founder of New Consciousness Review, and you can find her at ncreview.com and myself, since I am the review's editor. And additionally, I have my editing website, which is sacredwriting.com, just how it sounds, all one word. And we also have a website for What Wags the World, whatwagstheworld.com. And we have a Facebook page and all of the required social media connections. But we would love for people to come to our website, whatwagstheworld.com, and post comments, share your experiences, your non-ordinary or awakening experiences, or contact us directly. We would love to hear from people and continue the good work.
Thank you so much, Julie Clayton, and thank you so much, Marion Knight. I know you're not here, but perhaps you'll hear me. Thank you both for what you did. Thanks for including me. I can't tell you how honored I am to be in your book and to be your friend. Thank you.
Oh, Eva, thank you. It was just a delight on both counts.
Thank you, and have a wonderful evening.
You too. Good night.